Welcome, everybody. My name is Vajra Chegla. I'm from the political economist at the European Institute. And it's, not only a pleasure, it's just a joy to have Peter Hall here, who is a friend of many of us. And we were so lucky to get him as centennial professor at the European Institute. I can be very brief because I don't go into all his work. You know, you all have to read the three institutionalisms, what a paradigm change in policy making means, and, well, those who do models of capitalism also know about whom I'm talking. And now Peter works on growth regimes, which is, of course, interesting when you see that earlier he had worked on varieties of capitalism and that they are creating institutional equilibria, so to speak. He painted the still life, and now he shows us a movie of how things get back moving when the world economy is a bit at a standstill. I can be short on his biography. I just ask him whether he has been ever anywhere else than in this small provincial university where he teaches. And he said, no, nobody else ever gave me a job. So he was always at Harvard. But some of us know that at the time when he became a full professor, it was actually more difficult to go from assistant professor to full professor in Harvard than to get a job anywhere in the Ivy League. So in that sense, I think Harvard was lucky to get Peter Hall, and we are lucky to have him tonight. The hashtag for this event is #LSE Prof Hall. I don't know why they did it. Probably not to mix you up with the other halls that are around. I hope you join me in welcoming Peter Hall.
Thanks very much, Waltraud, for that nice introduction. I see that I'm competing with the LSE Christmas concert, and so I'm very grateful to you for being here in the front row. I feel like this is a PhD defense. The front row has the eminence greases of the European Institute in it. Well, and not so grease. I hope you don't view that as an insult. Always unwise to start a talk with an insult.
It is.
Usually. Can you all hear me? Yeah. Okay. So instead of starting with an insult, I'm going to start with a couple of data points. And there's the first one of them, so that you can compare the activities of the 10 largest American companies by market cap in 1960 and 2015. And I think I don't need to elaborate this a lot more. You can see the core manufacturing economy in 1960 and quite a different kind of economy in 2015. And you could also consider, if you want, job growth, value added in the British economy. And I think we can see pretty clearly here that the blue manufacturing line is continuously down, and knowledge-based services are continuously up. And so these figures suggest to me, and many more could be provided, is that the fundamental character of the developed political economies has changed dramatically over the past few decades. And with it, I think, and I want to suggest to you, that the basis for economic growth has also shifted over this time. And I think it's fair to say that we're now in an era of the knowledge economy. And so the question that I want to put before you is this. What are the challenges facing governments, governments seeking economic growth within this context of a knowledge economy, within this kind of knowledge economy? And pretty much every statement I'm going to make is going to be controversial and contestable. I'm sure you'll want to contest some of them, but I'm trying to describe the framework for a book that I'm trying to write, or at least a piece of it, that sketches out over a kind of long-term perspective how we would understand changes in the economy and the knowledge economy in particular. And so if we ask what are the challenges facing governments in the context of a knowledge economy, I think that's a question with two dimensions, both economic and political. And because it's a question about the basis for securing economic growth, it's an economic question. And because it's a question about that, it's also a question with political dimensions, because I want to suggest to you that economic policymaking is not simply a matter of finding the best technical solution to a problem. It also entails mobilizing consent for the policies that are to be pursued, consent among both producer groups and among the electorate. In other words, at the heart of my remarks today is the contention that economic policymaking is always also coalition building. Now, I'm not going to provide a dispositive answer to the question that I've just asked, what are the challenges, but I'm going to suggest a framework that we might use to approach this question, a question that I think many of us should be asking. So I'm going to provide something of a framework, and in so doing, I hope to fill some gaps in the field of comparative political economy. Comparative political economy has, of course, flourished in recent decades, not least because of the work being done here at the London School of Economics. But on my reading, the field suffers from two significant gaps. First of all, comparative political economy, in the way that I know it, was really born during the 1960s, in an era when manufacturing still dominated the economy. In subsequent decades, the 1980s and 90s, scholars, of course, took into account growing employment in services. But I think with only a few exceptions, the field has been slow to consider the import, the impact of what I'm thinking of as this fourth industrial revolution in information technology and biotech. And I think that fourth industrial revolution is changing the nature of employment and the basis for growth. And I think the field has not yet really come to grips with this knowledge economy. But I also think there's a second gap in the field, and I've contributed as much to it as anyone else. From its inception, and unlike some of you, I remember its inception, the field has been fixed on producer group politics. The study of trade unions and of employers' associations has long been the bread and butter of comparative political economists, some of my best friends. But as a result, there's long been a gulf between the study of comparative political economy on the one side and the study of electoral politics on the other side. The politics dominating the field has been the politics of producer groups. Now, in recent years, research on the welfare state in particular has taken an electoral turn, and there's some very interesting work in that. But I think we don't yet know much about how developments in the political economy, changes in the political economy, might be related to developments in changes in electoral politics. So one of the objectives of the research that I'm telling you about tonight is to try and fill in those gaps. So I want to do this by posing two questions, by putting the knowledge economy into a historical context. And I'm going to ask first, how have the growth regimes pursued by the developed democracies, so I'm thinking about the OECD countries, how have those growth regimes changed since the early 1950s? And then secondly, I want to ask, of course, what's the relationship between change in growth regimes and changes in electoral politics over this period? And in order to answer these questions, I'm going to crawl out very far on several limbs, and I'll be waving at the end of those limbs, and you can see if you want to try and chop them down or not. So this is a kind of very synoptic economic history, a set of preliminary observations. So the unit of analysis here is a growth regime, and I'm defining that as a central set of techniques which encompasses in particular policies, but also the institutions that policies support, techniques used by the core actors in the economy, notably governments, but we could also talk about firms and producer groups, the core actors, to techniques used to secure higher rates of economic growth. I'm leaving aside the question of whether higher economic rates of economic growth are desirable. There are issues there, but I'm thinking about growth regimes understood this way, and my emphasis tonight is going to be on public policies. So I think the core elements of a growth regime can be derived from a Cobb-Douglas function based on a standard solo model of this sort. And this is a model, of course, that specifies that economic growth depends on inputs of capital, inputs of labor, and on total factor productivity, namely the efficiency with which these inputs of capital and labor are used. And so this suggests, this is my anchor point, this suggests that governments interested in increasing the rate of economic growth should focus on policies that do one of three things: increase inputs of capital, or increase inputs of labor, or in some way or other increase the efficiency with which capital and labor are used in the political economy. And this notion, the notion that we need inputs of capital, labor, and productivity, remains constant over time in my specification. But of course, there are a wide range of policies that any one government might adopt to further those particular ends. And I want to suggest to you that the policies that the developed democracies have chosen for this purpose have changed quite dramatically over the last 50 to 60 years. Well, how might we characterize those changes? I'm going to do so by dividing the post-war years into three periods or three eras. First, I'm calling an era of modernization, prominent in the 1950s and 1960s, runs probably into the early 1970s. For any one country, the time periods here vary a little bit, so they're rather broad periods. The second is an era of liberalization, familiar to all of us, that begins in the early 1980s, and in my view runs to about 1995. And then the third is the era that I'm suggesting we're now in, which I'm calling an era of knowledge-based growth, which I'll say in a few minutes why I think it begins around 1995. Now, what I'm going to talk about tonight is the way in which movement through these eras has been parallel or broadly similar across the developed democracies. Certainly within those political economies, there are some very important differences in the trajectories that particular nations, particular political economies have taken, and I'm currently working on that, and you can ask me about that, and I won't be able to answer the questions, but I want to note that I'm emphasizing similarity over time in this particular case. So what were the principal characteristics of the growth regime of the era of modernization? I think they were these, and maybe this part isn't so controversial. Securing inputs of labor for a government, of course, means securing higher levels of employment. And this is a problem with which all governments were deeply concerned after World War II with the demobilization of the military. But most of the OECD governments did this extremely successfully using one of two techniques, I think, in the 1950s and 60s. Both techniques focused on promoting demand for a nation's products. So, of course, this was the era of Keynes, when Keynes' concepts of aggregate demand became widely influential, even if Keynes' own policy prescriptions were greeted with varying degrees of enthusiasm across countries. So one group of countries, including the UK, the US, and France, among others, adopted the active fiscal policies associated with countercyclical demand management. They used that to sustain domestic demand for their products, and in large measure their economy, growth in their economy was driven by consumption and domestic demand. By per contra, there are a group of states. Germany would be a classic case. The small states of northern Europe focused on building demand, but in this case demand for exports, and they did so by holding down their exchange rate. Germany artificially suppressed its exchange rate for quite some time, and encouraging coordinated wage bargaining to limit increases in unit labor costs. So increase employment through the promotion of demand. Securing inputs of capital in this period was seen as a problem, I think, by a large array of countries that mandated extensive intervention by the state. Intervention to channel domestic funds, the funds that were available, and they were initially scarce in the early 50s, into the late 50s, to channel those funds towards sectors and enterprises deemed most central to economic growth. And for this purpose, most of the developed democracies use state-owned enterprises, publicly owned banks, and in some cases, systems of industrial planning. And we see that in the UK as well as France, paradigmatic cases like France and Italy. Now, many European countries secured increases in productivity in this period, of course, simply by drawing semi-skilled workers out of agriculture into industry, where they could be instantly more productive using Fordist systems of manufacturing. And the dominant approach to building productivity in industry was to focus on economies of scale, making plants and firms larger so as to secure economies of scale. So I think these are the formulas that I see as being rather general across the developed democracies for the era of modernization. And I think we can characterize these growth regimes in comparison certainly to the ones of the interwar period as ones that involve movement toward more active government intervention, whether in the realm of macroeconomic policy, economic planning, or the orchestration of collective bargaining. By contrast, the growth regimes of the subsequent era, the era of liberalization, which begins in the 1980s, moved in the opposite direction. Right? So as we all know, this is an era marked by what might be termed a move to the market, right? Instantiated most obviously in the Single European Act of 1986. So the efforts of governments to secure higher levels of employment, i.e. inputs of labor in this period, shifted from an emphasis on the demand side of the economy to an emphasis on the supply side of the economy. And here the Nordic governments stand out for increasing public employment to address this problem, notably employment of women. But most of the developed democracies approached this problem as one that required labor market reforms to make temporary and part-time employment more feasible and to give firms more flexibility to set wages, which is to say to lower wages within coordinated bargaining systems. I think that is probably also uncontroversial. The approach of most governments to securing inputs of capital in this period also shifted, in my view. Efforts to orchestrate flows of national capital were abandoned in favor of new efforts to attract foreign investment, either portfolio investment or foreign direct investment. Following Britain's lead in 1979, exchange controls were abolished. That's virtually the first thing that Margaret Thatcher did on taking office. And protections for minority shareholders were strengthened across much of Europe. And many governments made mergers and acquisitions, including in some cases hostile takeovers, easier. The idea was to make it easier for foreign investors to take a share of a country's industry, thereby attracting foreign capital as opposed to the domestic capital on which many had relied in the previous era. And I think governments also approached the productivity problem quite differently in this period. It came to be seen as a problem that could be resolved by intensifying competition in labor markets and in product markets. And of course, this is the impetus behind the initiative to create a single European market, an initiative that effectively turned the European Commission into an agent for market liberalization. And at the national level, increasing productivity was to be improved by deregulation, the privatization of national enterprises, and we saw the deregulation of everything from air transport to telecommunications. And of course, in the US and the UK, most notably, although not so much elsewhere, increasing productivity was seen to depend on breaking the power of the trade unions. And Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher set out quite successfully to do precisely that. So, in short, between the era of modernization in the first period and the era of liberalization in the second period, I think we see a sea change in the growth regimes of the developed democracies. So before turning to this third era, the era of knowledge-based growth, I want to say something about the process whereby growth regimes change and the role of electoral politics in that process. So my goal is not just to characterize accurately the nature of the changes, it's to say something about why they happen. And I'm currently working with a framework that suggests that in order to explain why growth regimes change, and also why those changes take some directions rather than others, we need to take four sets of factors into account. And I'm sorry there are four of them. It would be nice if there were only one or two of them, but at least there are only four of them. So the first are important sets of developments in the economy, which matter in this framework because those developments in the economy change the nature of the challenges that governments face and the opportunities. They also change the opportunities that governments have for dealing with those challenges, for securing growth. The second thing that matters, though, are shifts in what I'm calling the economic gestalt of a given period, with apologies to Carl Jung. The economic gestalt is the interpretation that politicians and government officials give to contemporary economic developments, and the interpretation that they evoke in order to justify their actions. So the point here is that changes in growth regimes are not automatic adjustments to changes in the economy, but they're a reflection of prevailing interpretations of those economic changes. And the third set of factors, as I've suggested, is constituted by changes in the electoral arena that alter the terms on which coalitions of support for specific policies can be assembled. And the fourth is a parallel set of changes in the realm of producer group politics that alter, in particular, the influence of particular specific producer groups, the kinds of policies they seek, and the levels of cooperation on which governments can call from them to operate their growth regimes. My research on producer groups is still ongoing. I'm not going to discuss it today. I mean, I'm happy to discuss it in the question period. But I want to say something about how these other three factors, the first three factors here, contributed to the movement from the growth regimes of the era of modernization to the growth regimes of the era of liberalization. So secular economic developments matter. They shifted the challenges facing governments seeking growth. And in my view, three such economic changes taking place largely between the 1960s and the 1980s were most consequential for growth regimes. And these have been widely discussed, and they're probably familiar to everyone here. So I think I'm attaching importance to three kinds of economic changes. The first, of course, is a shift in the locus of employment from manufacturing to services. By 1980, any jobs that were going to be created in Europe or in America, for that matter, were going to be created in the service sector. But that meant that governments could no longer depend on the movement of workers from agriculture into industry to increase productivity. They had to find another solution to the productivity problem. And efforts to find work for those who were displaced from the manufacturing sector as a result of deindustrialization inspired deregulatory efforts to make part-time and temporary work more feasible. So that's the first of the developments that I think is important. The second development is, of course, an expansion in world trade, which culminates in the growth of the emerging economies in the early 1990s, which intensifies deindustrialization, among other things. And the third development that I see as important here was an exponential increase in international capital flows, which changed the terms on which firms were able to secure finance. So by the middle of the 1980s, inputs of capital were to come in much larger proportions from international rather than domestic sources. And this, as I just suggested a minute ago, lay in large measure behind the liberalization of national markets for corporate governance, as I see it. However, the liberalizing policies of the 1980s were not, I think, a purely automatic response to these changing economic conditions. You could see how economic conditions might matter, but they also reflected a shift in economic gestalt. And that shift in gestalt, I think, had its roots in the crises of the 1970s. I don't have time to say much about this. I'll just gesture at it. Some of you may have I lived through these. Indeed, I lived through them in Britain. I remember the winter of discontent. I was truly discontent in the winter of discontent. But basically, stagflation, rising rates of inflation, rising rates of unemployment, discredited Keynesian approaches to economic policy making. Especially in the Anglo-American democracies, they produced a backlash against state intervention. And they promoted doctrines, therefore, that abandoned the demand side of the economy and emphasized the supply side of the economy as the critical driver for growth and economic performance. And they gave rise, as we all know, because most people in this room grew up in that period, they gave rise to a diffuse sense that markets could allocate resources more efficiently than states, and that the route to a more productive economy lay in intensifying market competition. And that is not a view that you would have found dominating the media, for instance, in the 1950s or even the 1960s. And this shift in gestalt is visible in the declining number of references in English language books, which is what this diagram shows, to the mixed economy which I think was coined by The Economist magazine, if I'm not mistaken, was, if you like, the defining phrase of the era of modernization. It reflected a certain appreciation for government intervention. And you can see it rise throughout the period, its use in, how much do you learn from these things? I don't know, you learn something. How do you measure the economic gestalt? Well, this is my effort to at least indicate that there is something going there. And then you see in the 1980s rising numbers of references to market liberalization. Okay, so now we're moving into the realm of controversy. How might changes in electoral politics factor into such movements in growth regimes? And what features of electoral politics matter here? Well, in my formulation, what matters about electoral politics are the cleavage structures that specify the main axes of party competition. So cleavage structures define the terms in which parties compete against one another, and therefore the kind of issues or the kind of policies that are pressed on governing parties. That's the analytic move here. And so from this perspective, the key fact is that the most prominent electoral cleavage in the era of modernization, the 1950s and 60s, was a class cleavage, dividing manual and lower-level non-manual workers from a middle class, kind of working class of manual, lower-level non-manual workers, from a middle class composed of white-collar employees in managerial, supervisory, or professional positions. And you probably don't have time to look carefully at this slide, but this simply indicates the extent to which parties in Italy, Britain, France, and Germany drew support on various parties from going from the left to the right, from the middle class or the working class. And I think you can see quite clearly here that this is a period in which class politics was really central to electoral politics as a whole. My point is not simply that people voted their material interest. People, to some extent, always vote their material interest. My point is that many people saw politics in class terms, namely as a terrain in which parties representing a working class interest were arrayed against parties representing a middle class interest. And in Western Europe, one side of this divide was occupied by socialist and communist parties committed to central planning and the nationalization of enterprise on a large scale. Think how long it took the Labour Party to give up Clause 4 of its constitution. Probably it's going to put it back in now, I suppose, but anyway. On the other side were conservative and Christian democratic parties opposed to high levels of state intervention in the name of a commitment to free enterprise. So the salience of the class cleavage made the issue of how much state intervention to countenance absolutely central to electoral competition, and it forced the mainstream political parties to find middle ground on it. So the growth regimes of the mixed economy emerge from this electoral dynamic as a political compromise. This is a point that Klaus Offe and others have made before, as a political compromise designed to draw support from both the center-left and the center-right. And in Britain, this compromise took the form of the Keynesian welfare state that we know so well. In France, it was organized around indicative economic planning. And in Germany, I think it yielded a social market economy. So if you look at this slide, and I actually brought a pointer if I can remember where I put it. This is data that Philip Mano collected from party manifestos. It runs from the 1950s forward. And you can see this is the movement of the 1950s and the 1960s. Parties on the political right move toward the center. They move closer towards the social democratic parties as they embraced the politics and the policies of the mixed economy. So we see, and at the same time, I suppose we should say that socialist parties in this period abandoned their commitment to nationalization. They modified their own views at a series of party conferences, famous party conferences from Blackpool to Bad Godesberg. Well, so how then, if that's how electoral politics mattered, if I'm right, in the 1950s and 60s, how did electoral politics figure into the shift to a new growth regime, a liberal growth regime, in the 1980s? And I think it did so in two ways. First, the economic turmoil of the 1970s, centered on stagflation and sharply lower rates of growth, inspired an electoral backlash against interventionist incomes and industrial policies, as I said a minute ago, and made many voters more open to the market-oriented appeals of the political right. The extent to which that backlash occurred varies across countries. It was most apparent in Britain and the US, where there really was popular support for the planks in the initial platforms of Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher. But I think a second development, namely a shift in cleavage structures, was of even more general importance, more durable importance in many countries. And I think there are two sides to this shift, a shift in cleavage structures. On the one hand, the electoral salience of the class cleavage declines. That's what this figure shows. It declines pretty steadily from the 1960s as post-war prosperity improves the economic conditions of the working class. The transition to a service economy begins to blur lines of social class. And indeed, a convergence in party platforms also undercuts the class-based appeal of political parties. So that's the first effect of this shift in cleavage structures that we see in the 1970s and 1980s. On the other hand, as I think everyone here will know, the 1980s also saw the rising salience of a new cleavage cross-cutting the class cleavage, and this was the values cleavage, dividing voters who embraced the post-materialist values associated with the environment, human rights, identity politics, from those who remain attached to more traditional values associated with material security, immigration, the protection of national cultures. I'm calling this a values cleavage because it does involve values, but of course it involves more than values. It involves material interest in some ways as well. And it's notable that both sides of this shift in cleavages, both the post-materialist side and the authoritarian side, have roots in the economic developments of the 1960s and 1970s that I'm not going to go into. Well, how did this shift in electoral cleavages condition the growth regimes developed during this era of liberalization? In my view, it did so from two directions. The deregulatory policies of neoliberalism often had very adverse effects on the most vulnerable segments of the working class. A lot of people's jobs became more precarious. Lots of people lost their jobs. Deregulation was not particularly good for those at the low-income, low-skill component of the labor force. But because right authoritarian voters were more likely to come from this class, this values cleavage drove a wedge through the constituency that social democratic parties might otherwise have mobilized in opposition to neoliberal reform. So I think that this cleavage undercut the possibility of a coalition of working class defense that might have effectively resisted neoliberal policies. But the other side of the significance here, the other side of the movement, is that the rising salience of post-materialist values also drew a larger middle class constituency toward parties on the center right, on the center left. to social democratic parties. These are figures from Jane Gingrich and Celia Heuserman. They look at the class composition of social democratic parties. It's divided into types of regimes, but the story is absolutely the same, which is to say that the majority of social democratic parties in Europe today draw the majority of their votes not from the working class, but from the middle class, attracted in large measure by these post-materialist values. And I think this undercut the inclination of center-left parties to oppose neoliberal policies, not least because some of these middle-class voters benefited from those policies. So partly as a result, the big movement in party platforms in the 1980s was not a movement on the right. It's a movement on the left. It's not so apparent here, but this is an index of economic liberalism based on party manifestos. But you can see the left move, the parties of the left move considerably towards the right, towards neoliberal, economically liberal policies in the 1980s and early 1990s. In short, if we want to explain changes in growth regimes, I think we have to pay some attention to changes in electoral politics, and in particular to shifts in the cleavage structures of that politics. So this takes me to the contemporary period, which I'm calling this era of knowledge-based growth. And it takes me back to the question with which I began. What are the challenges facing governments seeking growth in a knowledge economy? Well, as I see it, this era is defined by rapid technological change associated with advances in information and communication technology, ICT, and biotechnology. And although these things have to be approximate, I kind of date the beginning of this era from about 1995, the mid-1990s, and I do that because that's the period when the number of patents that were issued both in Europe and in the U.S., these are U.S. figures, begin to expand exponentially. These are kind of small, but there's 1995 on this chart, and you can see a takeoff in patents. But this is also the period when, for the first time since the Second World War, the rate of growth of productivity increases faster in the U.S. than it does in Europe. Up till that point, of course, Europe has been enjoying the advantages of catch-up to the world technology frontier supposedly set in the U.S. Well, around 1995, that reverses itself, and it reverses itself, I think, in large measure, and there's some good data on this, because American companies, by the second half of the 1990s, are taking up new ICT technology much more quickly than their European analogs. Well, so once again, I think we can say that governments are being pressed to adopt new growth regimes by three sets of developments: a shift in economic conditions, A, B, a shift in economic gestalt, and C, changes in the cleavage structures of electoral politics. And that's what I want to tell you about before I close. So I'm going to outline these developments and the challenges they pose for governments seeking higher rates of growth. So recall that in this formulation, growth depends on increasing inputs of labor, inputs of capital, and attaining higher rates of productivity. Thanks to the work of Alan Manning and David Otor and Daniel Usch and their collaborators, it should be apparent how the technological revolution has altered the employment problem that governments face. Some of this is controversial, but I don't think it's that controversial. I'm more or less persuaded by it. As many routine jobs, not just in manufacturing, but also in services, become automated, the result has been a shift, a big shift, in occupational structures. Job growth is occurring primarily in occupations that require relatively high levels of analytical or social skills. In fact, the most recent evidence suggests, or my colleague Daniel Desmond suggests, that the biggest growth is for people who have both social skills and analytic skills. I guess too late to change your concentration at the LSE, but nonetheless. All right. in a few countries such as the U.S. and the U.K., I should say in the 1990s, there was also a growth in the low-skilled end of the occupational spectrum, although that seems to have been tailed off in the early 2000s. So at the same time, as the new technology allows firms to contract out more services, the share of employment in firms devoted to business services has been rising rapidly, and the figures are very interesting. Exports in business services across the OECD are also rising very rapidly. Therefore, the problem facing governments that devoted attention to job creation, therefore, the problem facing governments in the 1980s and early 1990s was how to create service sector jobs, and many of them resorted to creating low-wage, low-skill service sector jobs. Well, the problem has shifted. The problem is now how to create jobs in high-skill occupations, including high-skill services. At the same time, the challenge of how to secure inputs of capital has, I think, again, been transformed by developments in financial markets that are at least partly driven, not entirely driven, but at least partly driven by the new technology. So beginning with the invention of credit default swaps in 1994, another reason to start this era in the mid-1990s, new forms of financial derivatives, namely securities whose value is tied to the value of other securities, new financial derivatives have proliferated. In theory, hesitation in front of Richard Bronk here, but in theory, these derivatives make it possible to diffuse risk among counterparties, thereby allowing financial enterprises to operate at much higher leverage ratios. But of course, they also increase, as we know very well, systemic risks to which national financial systems are exposed. And so on the one hand, this development has made it possible for the financial, corporate, and household sectors in a lot of these countries to hold much higher levels of debt. On the other hand, that debt has not necessarily led to higher levels of investment, productive investment. I think there's a big puzzle there that I hope someone will solve. In the US and the UK, it's led instead to a vast expansion in financial services, as we know. And in more than a few countries, the profitability of firms has come to depend more than it used to on their financial rather than their productive operations. And of course, higher levels of consumer debt have fueled asset booms, housing booms, rather than more productive investment. So on the capital side, the problem facing governments has again shifted. It's become the problem of how to minimize the systemic risks that this kind of financial system poses without impeding flows of investment to productive enterprises. And you can see central bankers agonizing about that issue every day. So I think, finally, developments in this era have also changed the complexion of the productivity problem. On the one hand, I think productivity now turns more heavily than it used to on the extent to which firms actually incorporate and implement the new information and communications technology into their operations. And this is a process in which many European countries are lagging. The UK is not lagging. The UK is doing very well. The US is doing very well. This is a sort of interesting phenomenon of some consequence, I think, for varieties of capitalism. Governments, therefore, are facing new issues about how to provide incentives for firms to take up this technology and how to cope with the regulatory issues it raises. And it raises many, many issues. One reason, speaking very broadly, the European countries are lagging in ICT is the sector where the take-up is slowest is actually retail, right? So Europe should just catch up. But think about what that means, actually. What it means is doing away with the local boulangerie, doing away with the local butcher shop. It means, you know, moving towards Walmart rather than the local high street shop. And that is a regulatory issue with social as well as political implications. If you wonder about this, think about Uber, think about Airbnb and the issues. issues that they raise. So there's a new set of, when thinking about productivity, the challenges facing governments have, I think, changed. And of course, productivity also turns even more heavily than it has in the past on improvements to human capital, which lifts complex issues of educational reform and vocational training onto the top of the public agenda. So shifts in economic challenges, but I think in tandem with these developments, we've seen a shift in the economic gestalt. So as early as 1996, the OECD published the first of many reports declaring, and I'm quoting from them, that knowledge is now recognized as the driver of productivity and growth. Well, you can find very similar language in the 2000 Lisbon Agenda. We can go back to engrams from Google, if you like, and there you can see the rise in the number of references to the knowledge economy. So we might have real questions about, and some of you will have real questions about whether a knowledge economy exists, but it's clear that many people believe a knowledge economy exists, an accurate fact or an illusion to which I'm certainly contributing today. So by the turn of the 21st century, the notion of a knowledge economy had become a feature of common parlance, and this in turn had effects on governments' growth regimes. It's having effects. So in keeping with a new emphasis on human capital formation, as I think everyone here knows, policymakers have begun to reconceptualize social policy as social investment. So in many quarters, social policy is no longer seen as a form of social protection for those suffering at the hands of the market, but rather it's seen as a set of initiatives designed to feed the needs of the economy. And in this context, growth regimes are changing, albeit at a pace that varies across countries and in terms that are somewhat different. But I think four developments stand out if we want to characterize the growth regimes of the era of knowledge-based growth. First, and I realize I'm at about 45 minutes, so I'll close fairly quickly. Most of the developed democracies are now devoting more resources to increasing enrollments in tertiary education. This is a very striking phenomenon. Britain is in some sense in the lead. The Blair government committed itself to raising university enrollments to 50% of the population. In 1963, this is a figure from a book that I probably shouldn't admit I once read, but in 1963, an ordinary kid from the British working class had statistically greater chances of ending up in a mental institution than of ever graduating from university. So the world has dramatically changed since then. The laggard, as you may have noticed, is the United States in this context, which has not much increased tertiary education, but the increases have been dramatic in many other countries. So that's the first, I think, feature of that I want to emphasize of this knowledge-based growth, and it's an effort via social investment to increase employment, provide people with skills who can get the jobs that this economy offers. Second, family policy has been accorded new importance with a view to drawing more women into the labor force and to improving early childhood education and development on the premise that this will eventually improve the nation's human capital. Third, many governments have shifted their attention away from securing high volumes of industrial investment towards securing sources of venture capital, seeding startups seeking to innovate. French governments have put considerable sums into this. The Swedish governments have really done a great deal. They've turned their regional development funds into venture capital funds. And finally, I think urban policy has acquired new importance in this knowledge economy. Cities acquire a new importance because they're meant to be the concentrated areas where clusters of innovation can develop, therefore to attract what Richard Florida calls the creative class to build these clusters of innovation, urban amenities, housing, and the like, acquires an importance that it didn't have before. Well, what might we say then about the political challenges facing governments in this era of knowledge-based growth as they try to forge these new growth regimes? Well, once again, I think the placement of voters and parties in an electoral space vis-a-vis cleavages is really crucial to this issue. And I think at least three recent developments have been consequential for what governments can do with regard to these new growth regimes. First, in the wake of increases in female labor force participation, the political preferences of women have shifted. For decades, women tend, in Europe in particular, tended to be on the conservative side of the political spectrum. That's partly because many of them were more religious than men. But of course, there is no religion in Europe anymore. And instead, women are working, and working women are interested in social investment. They're interested in the work-life balance and the policies that feed that. They're interested in policies of early childhood development. And partly as a result, their political allegiances have shifted. Women voters, which were once an important reservoir for the political right, are now likely to vote for the left. Second, changes in occupational structure have increased the number of people who can be classified as sociocultural professionals. Almost everyone, if you wonder what that is, almost everyone here is a sociocultural professional. In most European countries, this group now composes 20 to 25% of the electorate. And it turns out, if we believe the survey data, that sociocultural professionals are less supportive than many others of traditional social policies, but they're more supportive of social investment than most other groups in the polity. And so both the increase in working women and the growing size and electoral prominence of sociocultural professionals have provided constituencies for these policies of social investment that governments are pursuing. But a third development is less propitious for the new growth regimes. And of course, this is the growing salience of an integration cleavage, dividing people who believe they are losing out as a result of these economic changes, typically losing out as a result of globalization, from others who have reason to think that they'll benefit from more open international markets. And in the latter category is pretty much everyone at the LIC. So since many of those who feel that they're losing out from these economic changes are susceptible to right authoritarian appeals, this has increased the number of voters at the bottom of the electoral spectrum. It's made European integration, the issue of European integration, a central issue, as we well know, on the electoral agenda in across Europe in particular. And many radical right parties have moved to the left on distributive issues in order to appeal to this growing group of left authoritarians. I can't remember if I have a slide for that. I don't. So, in other words, why does this matter? What can we say about electoral politics in this era of knowledge-based growth? Well, it means that parties, they can't mobilize on classes anymore. They have to seek, assemble, I think, ad hoc electoral coalitions within a much more fragmented electoral arena. And we don't yet know the full implications of this development, but I think there are three that are worth thinking about seriously. First, this means it's become more difficult for mainstream political parties to assemble governments capable of decisive action. Think of the French Prime Minister Pierre Mendès-France, who said, gouverner, c'est choisir, to govern is to choose. Well, we face serious economic challenges at a moment when it's very difficult for governments to assemble the majorities to do that. Secondly, since distrust of governments and distrust of open markets is rife within the right and left authoritarian part of the political spectrum, this, I think, might impede the capacity of many governments, including the American government, to deliver some of the public goods necessary to build a knowledge economy. And third, as parties try to build electoral coalitions that sort of circumvent those who may be distrustful of the government and distrustful of the knowledge economy, there's a real possibility that they'll do so around policies that leave some key group in society out. This is a chart that I've adapted from work by Herbert Kitchell, he's mapped where people's attitudes are on these two dimensions. This is the libertarian-authoritarian dimension. This is the traditional left-right spectrum. The one change I've made, I should say, from Herbert's work, which was done about 10 years ago, is I've moved routine operators down here. Because this is what's happened. The radical right parties have moved from this side of the spectrum. There are a lot. And this is the change. I don't have time, really. But, 15 years ago, although we had at least two dimensions to the electoral space, the parties could line up, and most of the voters lined up along a kind of diagonal like that. But that's partly because this quadrant was not populated. This quadrant is now heavily populated. And I think one of the big dangers of the contemporary period is that a coalition may be built for the growth regimes that I've been describing among sociocultural professionals, what Herbert calls mixed service functionaries. These are health technicians and the like, and even some financial managerial professionals over here. And that gives you a majority. It gives you a majority for some of the kinds of policies I've just described, and it leaves out a big segment of people who already think that they're the losers in the contemporary economy. So there's at least some danger that we may be seeing a one-third, two-third society such that some groups benefit from the flourishing of a knowledge economy, and there are others who pay the costs of that kind of economy. And I think on that point I'll stop.
Very good. Thank you.
So, you winners of the knowledge economy, what would you like to ask? Briefly introduce yourself, and then a succinct.
Some people can question. Still catch the Christmas concert.
Yes, some are keen. You just said they are all not religious, and then they leave.
Yes,
in the back.
Hi, thank you very much. It's Abby Innes from the Institute. I mean, I think you'd agree that a one-third, two-third economy sort of polity is what we've had in the UK and the US for a while now. I mean, we're arguably at the frontier of these two economies are at the frontier of the developments you're talking about. I wonder if you could... I mean, David Soskis was writing about the systemic exclusion of non-academic sort of... men, young boys in particular, falling out of education at 15 because of the absence from the 1980s onwards of a vocational training system. So we've sort of been heading in that direction rather clearly for 20 years already. What would be interesting is to hear how you think this affects coordinated market economies, because this is where, particularly in the Nordics, we're seeing this, because Sweden and Denmark are moving to the technological frontier very quickly in the last 10 years, and we can see their radical right parties outflanking the left on social policies, but with much more exclusive insider-outsider migration politics. I mean, potentially the politics of this are going to be far more radically unraveling for the status quo in the coordinated economies, it seems to me, and the social consensus.
Yeah.
That has underpinned those economies. Would you agree with that?
I'll preface my response by, as I perhaps frequently will, by saying I don't know. But I think that I don't know for sure. But you know, if you talk to political economists in the Nordic world, they're of course very worried, and I think they have good reason to worry. In Sweden, in particular. As a result of the privatization of welfare services, which is a policy that was initiated by the Social Democrats in response to an entirely understandable demand for more choice in education, more choice in health clinics, more choice in daycare, and in some ways was electorally popular when it was implemented. But if you think about that, that is a wedge. The Nordic countries are, of course, still far more inclusive on most of the dimensions we would want to measure than, say, the Anglo-American democracies. But there's a kind of thin end of a wedge there that, you know, we don't know whether it'll be driven in or not, but there certainly are signs in Sweden in particular that the sort of managerial professionals, some of the sociocultural professionals who have been mainstays of the center-left are moving more in a market direction and are less inclined to support those sorts of policies. So, you know, Sweden and Denmark are light years away from the UK in terms of inclusiveness, but there are movements in that direction there. And of course, as we know, in the continental countries, we see a dualism that in which we see the development of secondary labor markets, of precarious employment, part-time employment, often low wages alongside the core manufacturing sector. So I think that the one-third, two-thirds society, which is a German expression in the first instance, is a potential threat in all of these countries. It's not just, maybe the UK is the pioneer or the US. Yeah, no, I think it's a threat everywhere. Yes, are you going to moderate this? Yes, okay.
Peter, thanks for a very rich discussion. I fully agree with your emphasis on services, although I'd argue for a much more fine-grained breakdown of services to understand it more meaningfully. I'm going to limit myself to three very quick points so as not to tax the chairman's patience. The first is that in many areas what we're seeing is a fragmentation of the production process. That explains much of the decline of manufacturing with, for example, research divisions being pushed out to or outsourced, sales being outsourced, new networks and chains. So that's something you may want to reflect on in taking this further. Mm-hmm. Second, I wonder if there's a cleavage you're missing, a very important one, maybe one which reflects differences among countries. And that is if you think of the typical Labour voter in this country, he or she works for the National Health Service or social work or a university, and therefore the employees of the public sector as opposed to the employees of the private sector may be a much more critical cleavage in what you're talking about than some of these groupings that you've been aggregating. And third, question of measurement. Bob Solow makes the joke that you can see ICT everywhere except in the productivity data. So I wonder whether we're measuring things accurately enough in this newfangled knowledge economy where we don't quite know what we're talking about in terms of outputs.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, those are very good questions, not surprisingly. You're entirely right. I think on the first point, I entirely agree with you, and if there were more time, I would try and talk about this. I'm trying to think about it. There's really been a shift in the character of value chains, which I think that's partly what you're driving at. And it is an enormously important move, such that countries that once had to worry or did worry about the level of their exports now really need to worry about how much value added they're contributing to the products that are flowing in and then flowing out of the country. So that would be one direct way in which this speaks to, I think, some of the issues that I'm concerned about, namely, how have the things that governments might have to worry about changed? I quite agree with you that that this is important. And outsourcing is certainly very important, and it also speaks to, you didn't make this point, but it speaks to measurement problems. You know, the great growth in business services, for instance, in Germany, which is not exactly where you would have expected it, has, I think, a lot to do with contracting out, such that services that were once performed inside manufacturing companies, Siemens and Daimler and what have you, are now performed by companies devoted to business services, and it shifts the figures, so it's hard to know exactly what's going on. On the private public-private sector divide, I mean, your point is well taken. I'm quite influenced, I'm not sure whether I should be, but I'm quite influenced by the arguments of Herbert Kitchelt and others that the character of the work one does and the extent to which it involves interpersonal interaction can be quite influential for how one thinks about values issues in particular. And your point is very well taken. I'll look, and your basic point is entirely right, that, of course, a lot of the support for the center-left comes from the public sector. a lot of things are going on there, and I'm trying to get a handle on the other, if I can just say this, other really interesting thing that's happening there is that ICT professionals, especially engineers, especially Silicon Valley types, whom you would expect to be over here, are increasingly over here. They're not very keen on redistribution. They are tolerant. They have sort of post-materialist values, but they're so there's some this category hides, I think, quite a bit, and I'm not quite sure what to do about that. But so yes, maybe the public-private divide, but also this very interesting move in which, on some sort of Schumpeterian vision of the economy, software engineers are not behaving in the way that Kitchell would think they would. And you're quite right about the measurement issues for ICT, and I'm not qualified to comment at length on those, but and there's, of course, this big debate, and there are plenty of people, Robert Gordon being probably the most famous, who think that the effects of the knowledge economy are deeply overstated, right? And that this is a flash in the pan that will not fundamentally alter the way in which these economies operate or the levels of growth they can attain. I'm vaguely persuaded by those who argue that current ways of measuring productivity don't capture very well the ways in which ICT increases productivity, but I wouldn't want to have to defend that position in front of this audience.
So Jan, over there. Then.
Thank you. I'm Jan Komarek, also from the European Institute. I'm not a political economist or a political scientist, so apologies for a possibly irrelevant question, but I wondered when you introduced this notion of integration cleavage in the context of the knowledge-based economy, and could you explain a bit more the relationship? Because to me, the integration cleavage is more about liberalization. So there where you can have some contestation about the extent to which you want to liberalize and also integrate. But can you really have any meaningful contestation about the level of knowledge-based economy you want to achieve? Because whereas as a lawyer understand it, then liberalization is a matter of a political choice which you can somewhat influence through the kind of regimes you enter into. But with knowledge-based economy, that's, I think, outside of political control. So can you just explain this a little bit more?
Peter, can I take one more question?
Yes, sure, yes.
Okay, since the first student has raised his hand, I want Lawrence. Yeah, good, great.
Hi, my name is Lawrence Koss. I study political economy in Europe at the European Institute, and my question would be, if we talk about those so-called losers, they tend to be usually badly educated, older as well, would you have any policy recommendations to include them in this knowledge economy?
No, I do. I'm grateful for that. And those two questions go together pretty well. Shall I respond?
Yes, go ahead.
So I take the term integration cleavage from Hans-Peter Kriese's work. The simplest way I can respond is to say, yes, broadly speaking, you're right. I mean, what leads people to feel that they are losing out in the current state of affairs? And, I think that the survey data shows that a lot of people who, are down at this end of so the values cleavage arises first, right? And the peculiar thing is that the integration cleavage tends to absolutely parallel, so that roughly the same people down here have on the one hand anti-immigrant attitudes and on the other hand feel that they are potential losers from contemporary economic developments. And when they think about those contemporary economic developments, at least based on my reading of the data, yes, you're right. They're thinking about liberalization. They're thinking about globalization. They're not really thinking about the knowledge economy. On the other hand, they don't necessarily, if you think about it, I doubt the knowledge economy is going to be built on national protectionism. Right, so that there are linkages between the developments that they're worried about take the activities of the European Union and the kinds of endeavors that you could imagine a government that wants to promote growth in this knowledge context might be taking. There are some open issues there. You know, maybe it's possible to have a successful knowledge economy without as much openness, that is, say, trade openness, financial openness, as Europe has recently had. Maybe that's possible. I guess I think it's unlikely, but I think it should be entertained. Is it possible to do it with a more social protection and a less market competition? Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And that, I mean, that takes me to your point. I'm not at this. So I'll show you the alternative coalition, right? Did I show you this? There's the alternative coalition, right? This would be the inclusive coalition for the. Don't push me too hard on this, but this would be the alternative coalition for the knowledge economy, right? And it includes those who might otherwise be the losers, and it's a coalition between them and sociocultural professionals and a few others, notably these mixed service functionaries. So one of the questions I'm asking myself is, you know, when do we get this and when do we get that and why? And I don't know the answer to that yet. But I do think that there's very good data that shows, for instance, that spending on early childhood development, early childhood education, first of all, can deliver very, very big economic benefits. So it can be a important form of social investment. That's point A. Point B, whether it delivers those returns or not depends very heavily on its quality. In other words, a lot of spending on early childhood development that seems not to deliver such returns because it's low quality. And thirdly, there are limits to what it can deliver because the cognitive and social skills of most five-year-olds already vary quite dramatically, as I imagine you know, at the age of five, based on their parental income or their parental socioeconomic status. And that portion of the variance is resistant even to superior primary school education. And what does that mean? That means that education is not the magic tool that is somehow going to lift all boats and create an inclusive society and a successful knowledge economy. I mean, I think you can't have a successful knowledge economy without increasing the skill levels of some of the people in this quadrant here. And I think the data suggests that you can't do that simply by providing somewhat better primary education and early childhood development. You also have to address the fundamental issues of social inequality at the level of the family. Because there's that, primordial gap that education alone isn't going to address. So there are real arguments, and they're not just arguments for noblesse oblige type arguments. I mean, an economy is going to be more productive if it can increase the skill levels of that.
I work my way forward. This person there. Yep.
Thank you. Last week, Richard and Daniel Susskind spoke here regarding the a book they had just written, and it was the crux of it was that the professional classes don't know what's going to hit them in terms of employment prospects in 10 to 20 years. I mean, what the type of thing that journalists are now facing or is going to be faced by doctors and barristers, management consultants, and so on. My question would be, are you an optimist or a pessimist regarding this question of large-scale unemployment, not simply amongst the undereducated or the people, the school leavers, but even amongst those receiving tertiary education?
Richard here in front, and then James behind.
Richard Bronk, LSE, European Institute of LSE. Fascinating talk, Peter. I wanted to ask about the impact of technology directly on electoral politics? I mean, you've talked about the economic impact of technological changes and then the associated ideational and political impact of those changes, so that you get these economic changes and then the changes in economic gestalt and electoral politics running in parallel and interacting with each other. Mm-hmm. But what about the direct effects of technological change on the mechanisms of electoral politics itself? I mean, just as Fordism made it very easy to mobilize union-based class support, do the new technologies make it much easier to mobilize and organize relatively small but widely dispersed groups of losers very, very quickly and very effectively, for example?
And one more, is that okay?
Yeah.
Just behind.
My name is Piotr Kowalczyk from the, I'm staying at the European Institute. My question is very much linked to the question
earlier this afternoon, right?
Yeah.
Yes, okay.
It's very linked to the question about Richard Susskind's talk. What is there really a possibility for a coalition in the center, given that the number of losers will increase dramatically and that the space in the center is still monopolized by two parties, which is center-left, center-right?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Space for what kind of coalition?
For a single coalition in the center, for a party which would implement, I mean, go for the knowledge economy. Don't you think that the opposition would just be stronger?
Okay. All right. Well, some of this is easy. Most of it's easy. So I'm an optimist, but this is totally meaningless because I don't know enough about the subject to really know whether I should be an optimist or a pessimist. I mean, it's a manifestly an important issue. I mean, think about higher education. I mean, the big growth component of higher education in the U.S. is adjunct lecturers, right? And you know, that's not exactly automation that is doing that. There are a variety of other forces that are doing that. But, you know, there's an issue that, you know, many of us can appreciate as a serious journalist are not the only people whose jobs are under threat. I guess that...
I mean, mentally, can people cope with a gig economy?
Yeah.
You know, that's... How can you get a mortgage if everyone's a freelancer?
Well, indeed. I've just applied for a grant to study the implications of the gig economy, and so check back with me in 2 years, you know. My experience, or at least my perception, is that governments will adjust to this. I mean, and that's what I think is so fascinating about this. They have to, right? And there'll be political contestation about that, and also new interpretations of what this means. And that's kind of the dynamic that I'm trying to describe, even if I don't know where the end point is, really. I realized as I was writing this talk that I don't have a very clear end point to it, right? But at least I've tried to describe the process based on the process as I've seen it in the past. I've tried to describe the politics of what I think is going on is, in some sense. The point relevant to yours that I think bears emphasizing is that I don't think we can assume that there's a kind of Say's law that operates in this realm such that if we increase everybody's skill levels, we'll automatically provide the jobs for people with those skills. I mean, that's something that really concerns me, and I don't know the literature on that very well. Other people here might. I'm not sure there is a very big literature on that. I think that there are a lot of people who've assumed on the basis of some good economic history that it does tend to be the case that if you can improve the skills of the workforce, and you can think of any country if you want. Think about Southern Europe, for instance, which I think about in the context of the euro crisis. You know, I think that the Southern European countries, like many, need to move to a higher value-added type of economy. Well, how do you do that? Is education enough? It's not clear to me that education is enough. I think we shouldn't assume that by investing in human capital, that alone solves the problem, but I don't know more than that. All I know is that I see that problem. And Richard, it's a great question, and I have no idea what the answer is. In other words, yes, it should be asked, and I have some students who are starting to ask it. You know, social media, has this changed the terms on which mobilization is possible? Well, I think probably manifestly it has to some extent. I think you know, Podemos, Los Indignados, maybe Pegida. These movements are to some certainly facilitated by social media, right? But I think for me the big question is, all right, so the media makes it possible to get people out into the street, and it probably also, and here I'm really beyond my ken, but it probably also makes it possible to form kind of electronic affinity groups, right? There are probably people in this room who know a lot more about this than I do. How does that translate into the kinds of appeals that we could expect parties to mount successfully? You know, it could mean the same thing that it seems to mean for contemporary media, which is to say fragmentation, right? It could mean that every group of 25,000 people has its own political affinity group, and in some sense, parties' capacities to mobilize large groups of people are actually attenuated rather than improved. Or it could mean that, you know, using in the hands of, you know, the conservative central office or Labour's National Executive Committee, social media provides a new way for the party to appeal to, I shouldn't have mentioned Labour, a new way to appeal to people in a durable way. I mean, my big questions are about the durability of this, and there are questions about on what basis can parties appeal to people, because my perception, which I'm persuaded is right, is that now that people are spread, you know, now that they're not running just, you know, along relatively, I mean, this is always an overstatement, but not running all that coherently along a left-right cleavage, and they're not running all that coherently along a diagonal here, but they're spread all over the place. The issue is, what's the basis on which parties can mount a durable appeal? And is it possible for them to do that? Or is it election by election, some package of multiple policies you put together and you gather small constituencies, and that becomes the basis of electoral politics? I don't know the answer to that, but I think it's the right question. And that also speaks to some extent to your question the best that I can. Yes. I mean, I think that, this is the most likely electoral coalition. This is a centrist electoral coalition. The problem is that there's some important groups that aren't in it. If you said to me, well, you have to put money down on what electoral coalitions will arise in this new context and run the knowledge economy, that's where I would place my current bets. And it is a centrist coalition, but it's not an inclusive coalition.
Now you're coming up.
My answers are too long.
James.
My question was addressed.
Okay, then there's Sebastian. And then one more there.
Hi, my name is Sebastian. I'm a PhD student in the European Institute. My question may not seem directly related, but I still want to ask it. And it's at the outset of your intriguing talk, you said that economic policymaking is inherently political because it always involves coalition building, and I'm very sympathetic to that argument. But I was wondering if you take a subset of economic policy, namely monetary policy, which in the developed economies, as we all know, is delegated to more or less independent central banks. Now, once such a delegation takes place, are these agents then out of the coalition building game? Why or why not?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Sebastian, could you pass it over to Hanan Haber?
Hi, Hanan Haber from the LSE Government Department. I'm a fellow. The question I'd like to ask is about asking if there's room to question the concept of growth or the assumption of constant growth. I mean, I'm not much of an environmentalist, but there's the claim that further growth is just unsustainable. But even if you don't go to the environmental aspect, I mean, you mentioned how much of production is basically financial production and household debt and a bubble in housing, and that's where the money is coming from. So that's where growth is coming from. So growth no more, I don't know. That's
Is it desirable? Is the question, is growth desirable?
Or is it even feasible? Is it, assuming that growth will continue to happen into the next 50 years, is that...
Oh, yeah, okay. Right. By giving such a loose, expansive talk, I've invited these loose, expansive questions.
Now,
my own fault.
That's the clever
fraud
question.
So the monetary policy question is a really good question, and I will simply say that, you know, there is an alternative view of this world that I've just described, which has some very powerful exponents. Wolfgang Straeck would be one of them, I think, my friend and frequent combatant. without associating with any one person, but Wolfgang Straeck, Colin Crouch, Peter Meyer before his death to some degree, without saying that any one of them would have said any of these things, on the whole, there's an image which suggests that the big movement has not been shifts in the character of electoral democracy. The big movement has been a shift away from the meaningfulness of electoral democracy towards some kind of technocracy, in Straeck's views, from a growth state. He starts out where I am, but then we get the debt state, and then we get the consolidation state. And, you know, the consolidation state looks very ugly, right? And it looks highly technocratic. And there's plenty of support for that view, notably in the extent to which the European Union has become influential in the making of many kinds of economic policies, right? And central bank independence would be a classic example of that. I think there's something in that. You know, in other words, I think that there's a movement that is sort of off stage from my particular talk here and from sort of my particular obsession. It pushed on it. In the end, I do think that governments have to survive elections, and therefore shifts in cleavage structures really do matter to these things. But you could add to that the fact that these people aren't voting, right? And there are a lot of different reasons why that might be the case. Of course, more of them are now voting for Marie Le Pen than they used to, but. All right, so yes, not every, you know, the other kind of answer I would give to you is, and in fact, it's a very serious issue, and I should say something about it. So I've tried to identify a range of policies that I think go into a growth regime, right? Well, some of those are more electorally salient than others, right? And one of the big issues I've been trying to resolve and didn't address here is, Which of these kinds of policies do become sensitive to fluctuations in the electorate, and which of them are largely insulated from that, right? And so, as a crude cut into it, social policy is, I think, broadly speaking, often electorally salient. Policy on funding for research and development is not, right? And so I think one of the next stages in this project is to look at the different components that might go in, the different kinds of policies that might go into a successful growth regime for this kind of economy, and to think about which ones are going to be sensitive to electoral pressure and which ones are going to be an artifact probably of producer group politics, right? So, and then I have almost no time, but is economic growth desirable? Is economic growth feasible?
It's
a good question. No, you're absolutely right. It's a good question. It's just I don't know the answer to it. I think it's desirable. I think it's desirable. Are we going to get it? I don't know. What's the answer, Paul?
Too late.
All right. Good question.
Could we get the lecture slides?
Oh.
Wow. Yes. We work on him.
Yeah, sure. why not?
Good.
It's an open intellectual community.
Have you all noticed
it only took me about 4 days to put them together, but sure. And 4 months to find them, but sure.
Okay. Thank you all for a really good lecture.